Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 23rd, 2003. Today's session is entitled An Hour with the Poet Laureate, Billy Collins, and it's session one of An Hour with the Poets, presented by David Wee, number WED-2003-06. Let's listen in.
Welcome to this session. My name is David Wee. I'm a teacher of English at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. This is a session called An Hour with the Poet Laureate. And it's going to be not a learned lecture, just to let you relax. You know, it's not going to be a scholarly presentation. I'm going to primarily read Billy Collins' poetry to us. So, you know, we can sit back, relax, let poetry work on your system the way it often does. And I hope that by the end you'll be better acquainted with our poet laureate and with poetry in general. Karen and I came to learn and read and understand and enjoy his poetry about a year ago, and when we got a book of his poetry, and then later another one. But we've become doubly fond of him in a personal way, because one of the jobs of the Poet Laureate of the United States is to administer two writing fellowships that are governed by the Library of Congress. His office is in the Library of Congress overlooking the nation's Capitol building. And he can pick any two writers in the whole country to receive these two fellowships to support their writing. And last January, he picked our daughter. She's a wonderful poet, and so we're especially fond. And as one of her jobs as a recipient of this was to give a public reading at the Library of Congress in April. So Karen and I and all the family went. You know, this is a rare occasion. So we were there, and it was wonderful to have our daughter honored and reading in this auspicious place. And then Billy Collins invited us out to eat afterwards, so we spent a couple of hours in an Italian restaurant with him, and he was so impressed that all of Rebecca's family was there, which had never happened before apparently, that at one point in the dinner he stood up and raised a glass to the Wee family for such support of our honored poet that night. So we're very fond of him personally as well. I know some of you have heard him read his poetry at other places, because one of the things that a poet laureate in our country does is to try to make poetry more public and visible and audible in the country, and help more and more of us get into poetry. So he has, I think, been quite active in traveling around the country and doing readings, and a few of you have told me that you've heard him read. And I wish he would be here to read his poems, but since he's not, I'll read them for him. Normally, a poet laureate, it's kind of an odd term. It's a Latin term, and it came from England when the royalty, the monarch, would appoint a poet to write things on occasion, such as the king's birthday or the queen's anniversary. And the poet laureate would simply get an annual stipend and live comfortably, which poets rarely do, and honor the monarch with poetry on special occasions, the winning of battles and national anniversaries. Well, fortunately, our poet laureates do different sorts of things. One of the goals of the previous poet laureate, whose name was Robert Pinsky, was to create what was called the National poetry project, and where all of us in the country were invited to submit a poem that was extremely meaningful in our lives. And he has published, I think now, two collections of these books, which include the person's testimony to why I chose this poem. And here are poems submitted by prisoners and veterans of warfare and all sorts of situations who testified to the fact that this poem saved my life or, you know, changed my conditions immensely. And those are wonderful books. Billy Collins has just published one called Poetry 180, in which his goal is to make sure that there is a poem for the day for all high schools in the country. And roughly there are 180 teaching days in the school system. So he wants to encourage schools to publish or read over the intercom, you know, a poem a day, and he wants them to be modern poems by contemporary people, and poems that are simple and understandable, rather than just the famous old poems by dead white guys that students often don't understand or enjoy. He calls high school the place where poetry goes to die. And wants to turn that around 180 degrees and with 180 poems. So if you see this in the bookstore someplace, it's a wonderful thing. He also chose one of our daughter's poems for So what I'm going to do is read as many as we can in this hour. We'll be done at 11:45. Of the poems that I like particularly, and hope that you will as well. And what I encourage you to do is close your eyes if you wish, and try to hear the language and the metaphors that Billy Collins uses. One of the things I like so much about him is that he is always surprising with the pictures that he draws. And he warps space and time in such fascinating ways, and causes us to think about common topics in sometimes hilarious, but always intriguing ways. I'm going to read some poems that are about teaching, especially teaching college students. Some that are about poetry and literature. Some that are about various human characteristics, a few poems that have theological or biblical basis to them, and some poems about time. He's very fascinated with the passage of time. And, you know, if any of you feel moved to comment about any of these poems after you hear them, why, please do so, and I'll perhaps comment on a few. But our main purpose here is to revel in the beauty of the words and the cleverness of a mind at work trying to make us understand the human condition by seeing things in a different way. And that's basically what good writers do. They find the right words and put them in the right order, and all of a sudden we see and understand something that we've been walking by all the time and seeming to miss it. One of my favorites is called Introduction to Poetry, because I teach poetry in college. And what he says here is fascinating, and perhaps will speak to many of us about our experience with learning poetry. And most of his poems are about a page long. They aren't very long, and most of the poems I've picked are relatively short, so that if your concentration is fading after pizza and coffee, you know, you can not fall too far adrift. Introduction to Poetry. I ask them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into the poem and watch him probe his way out. Or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do, talking about college students here, all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means. And that's a wonderful corrective to all of us, you know, who want to analyze every ounce out of poems.
Just a thought there, that's not a bad way of describing sometimes the way we look at scripture.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly.
We always try too hard and too intensely instead of kind of waiting and see what comes to us.
That's right. That's right. We insist that there's one way to get it, and we're going to find the meaning in the. And in literature, of course, which works so much by indirection and by symbols, we're always trying to assume that every detail refers not to itself but to something else, some abstract idea. And that's part of the beating with the holes. This one is called Schoolsville. Schoolsville. And it's I'm nearing the end of my teaching career, and here's the voice of an English teacher who has done that. Glancing over my shoulder at the past, I realize the number of students I have taught is enough to populate a small town. I can see it nestled in a paper landscape, chalk dust flurrying down in winter, nights dark as a blackboard. The population ages but never graduates. On hot afternoons, they sweat the final in the park, and when it's cold, they shiver around stoves, reading disorganized essays out loud. A bell rings on the hour, and everybody zigzags into the streets with their books. I forgot all their last names first, and their first names last, in alphabetical order. But the boy who always had his hand up is an alderman and owns the haberdashery. The girl who signed her papers in lipstick leans against the drugstore, smoking, brushing her hair like a machine. Their grades are sewn into their clothes like references to Hawthorne. The A's stroll along with all the other A's. The D's honk whenever they pass another D. All the creative writing students recline on the courthouse lawn and play the lute. Wherever they go, they form a big circle. Needless to say, I am the mayor. I live in the White Colonial at Maple and Main. I rarely leave the house. The car deflates in the driveway. Vines twirl around the porch swing. Once in a while, a student knocks on the door with a term paper 15 years late. Or a question about Yeats or double spacing. And sometimes one will appear in a window pane to watch me lecturing the wallpaper, quizzing the chandelier, reprimanding the air. There were so many here that I wanted to read that I just had to be hard on myself and pick out a few. But again, these are the ones that have to do with teaching and learning in school. This one's entitled The Lesson. In the morning, when I found history, capital H, when I found history snoring heavily on the couch, I took down his overcoat from the rack and placed its weight over my shoulder blades. It would protect me on the cold walk into the village for milk and the paper, and I figured he would not mind, not after our long conversation the night before. How unexpected his blustering anger when I returned covered with icicles. The way he rummaged through the huge pockets, making sure no major battle or English queen had fallen out and become lost in the deep snow. Here's one called First Reader. Those of us who learn to read at a certain time might respond well to this. I can see them standing politely on the wide pages that I was still learning to turn. Jane in a blue jumper, Dick with his crayon brown hair, playing with a ball or exploring the cosmos of the backyard. Unaware, they are the first characters, a boy and girl who begin fiction. Beyond the simple illustration of their neighborhood, the other protagonists were waiting in a huddle. Frightening Heathcliff, frightened Pip, Nick Adams carrying a fishing rod, Emma Bovary riding into Rouen. But I would read about the perfect boy and his sister even before I would read about Adam and Eve, garden and gate, and before I heard the name Gutenberg, the type of their simple talk was moving into my focusing eyes. It was always Saturday, and he and she were always pointing at something and shouting, "Look!" Pointing at the dog, the bicycle, or at their father as he pushed a hand mower over the lawn, waving at aproned mother framed in the kitchen doorway, pointing toward the sky, pointing at each other. They wanted us to look, but we had looked already and seen the shaded lawn, the wagon, the postman. We had seen the dog, walked, watered, and fed the animal, and now it was time to discover the infinite. Clicking permutations, the infinite clicking permutations of the alphabet's small and capital letters. Alphabetical ourselves in the rows of classroom desks, we were forgetting how to look, learning how to read.
Question?
Yes.
Back in the good old days, when I knew poetry, it rhymed and had meter. This has neither. Why is this poetry as opposed to prose?
Good question, huge question. We perhaps need a special hour on that. But the simple answer would be that poetry is language carefully chosen and arranged to compress things into a fairly small space. But rhyme and alliteration and onomatopoeia and stanza forms are not essential for it. We've come to like and memorize, you know, poems that do rhyme and have a kind of regular rhythm. In some ways, you could take any set of words, take a paragraph, prose, lay them out on the page, put them in a certain way, they look like a poem, and we often refer to prose poems when the writer has picked the language so particularly as to make us sit up and take notice, and rhyme is not essential for that, and regular rhythm isn't either.
So is this prose poetry then?
No, this I would call just good old poetry without rhyme, and different length of every time, different stanza.
Or am I beating you with a hook?
Pardon?
Am I beating you with a hook?
Yeah, that's right. Poetry is a way of using language that focuses us, causes us to hear the beauty of the language, which is more important than whether it rhymes or alliterates and so forth.
This is less sing-songy than something that has meter and rhyme.
Yes, that's right. It's easier to sing and to memorize and so forth, more regular poetry. But what many of us find is that this kind of detail, he's pulling us out of our normal patterns and using images from all over the place that are speaking to us. You don't have to rhyme to do that. This one is called The History Teacher. Trying to protect his students' innocence, he told them the Ice Age was really just the Chili Age. A period of 1,000,000 years when everyone had to wear sweaters. And the Stone Age became the Gravel Age, named after the long driveways of the time. The Spanish Inquisition was nothing more than an outbreak of questions such as, how far is it from here to Madrid? Or, what do you call the matador's hat? The War of the Roses took place in a garden, and the Enola Gay dropped one tiny atom on Japan. The children would leave his classroom for the playground to torment the weak and the smart, mussing up their hair and breaking their glasses, while he gathered up his notes and walked home past flower beds and white picket fences, wondering if they would believe that soldiers in the Boer War told long, rambling stories designed to make the enemy nod off. Interesting commentary on our tendency to try to soften and euphemize everything that...
the history so many of us were taught in schools, and to find out that it isn't that way when you adulthood is a great moment of awakening.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Good. This one is called Marginalia, and this is 2 pages long, so it's a little longer, but it's about writing the comments in the margins of the books we read. Marginalia. Sometimes the notes are ferocious, skirmishes against the author raging along the borders of every page in tiny black script. If I could just get my hands on you, Kierkegaard, or Connor Cruz O'Brien, they seem to say, I would bolt the door and beat some logic into your head. Other comments are more offhand, dismissive. Nonsense. Please. Ha! That kind of thing. I remember once looking up from my reading, my thumb as a bookmark, trying to imagine what the person must look like who wrote, "Don't be a ninny," alongside a paragraph in The Life of Emily Dickinson. Students are more modest, needing to leave only their splayed footprints along the shore of the page. One scrawls, "Metaphor," next to a stanza of Eliot's. Another notes the presence of irony 50 times outside the paragraphs of A Modest Proposal. Or they are fans who cheer from the empty bleachers, hands cupped around their mouths. Absolutely, they shout to Dun Scotus and James Baldwin. Yes, bullseye, my man. Check marks, asterisks, and exclamation points rain down along the sidelines. And if you have managed to graduate from college without ever having written Man versus Nature in a margin, perhaps now is the time to take one step forward. We have all seized the white parameter as our own and reached for a pen, if only to show we did not just laze in an armchair turning pages. We pressed a thought into the wayside, planted an impression along the verge. Even Irish monks in their cold scriptoria jotted along the borders of the Gospels brief asides about the pains of copying, a bird singing near their window, or the sunlight that illuminated their page. Anonymous men catching a ride into the future on a vessel more lasting than themselves. And you have not read Joshua Reynolds, they say, until you have read him and wreathed with Blake's furious scribbling. Yet the one I think of most often, the one that dangles from me like a locket, was written in a copy of Catcher in the Rye I borrowed from the local library one slow, hot summer. I was just beginning high school then, reading books on a Davenport in my parents' living room, and I cannot tell you how vastly my loneliness was deepened, how poignant and amplified the world before me seemed when I found on one page a few greasy-looking smears, and next to them written in soft pencil by a beautiful girl, I could tell, whom I would never meet. Pardon the egg salad stains, but I'm in love. All right, now a few more that have other references to literature. This next one is called Advice to Writers. Poets are always giving writing workshops and teaching young people how to do the same thing. This is advice to writers. Even if it keeps you up all night, wash down the walls and scrub the floor of your study before composing a syllable. Clean the place as if the Pope were on his way. Spotlessness is the niece of inspiration. The more you clean, the more brilliant your writing will be. So do not hesitate to take to the open fields to scour the undersides of rocks or swab in the dark forest upper branches, nests full of eggs. When you find your way home and stow the sponges and brushes under the sink, you will behold in the light of dawn the immaculate altar of your desk, a clean surface in the middle of a clean world. From a small vase, sparkling blue, lift a yellow pencil, the sharpest of the bouquet, and cover pages with tiny sentences like long rows of devoted ants that followed you in from the woods. And by indirection, he's advising them to be creative with their thinking and their language. Here's one that attests to our human jealousy. It's called The Rival Poet. The column of your book titles, always introducing your latest one, looms over me like Roman architecture. It is longer than the name of an Italian countess, longer than this poem will probably be. Etched on the head of a pin, my own production would leave room for the Lord's Prayer and many dancing angels. No matter. In my revenge daydream, I am the one poised on the marble staircase high above the crowded ballroom. A retainer in livery announces me and the Contessa Maria Teresa Isabella Veronica Montelira Eleganza de Bella Ferrari. You are the one below, fidgeting in your rented tux, with some local Cindy hanging all over you. This one is entitled American Sonnet, and the sonnet has gone out of fashion, but we all remember the sonnet, 14 lines, iambic pentameter, certain rhyme scheme, either Elizabethan or Italian, by Shakespeare or Spenser or Petrarch, compressing everything into that 14-line space. Here's his analysis called American Sonnet. We do not speak like Petrarch or wear a hat like Spencer, and it is not 14 lines like furrows in a small, carefully plowed field, but the picture postcard, a poem on vacation that forces us to sing our songs in little rooms or pour our sentiments into measuring cups. We write on the back of a waterfall or lake or mountain, he might have said, adding to the view a caption as conventional as an Elizabethan woman's heliocentric eyes. We locate an adjective for the weather. We announce that we are having a wonderful time. We express the wish that you were here and hide the wish that we were where you are. Walking back from the mailbox, your head lowered as you read and turn the thin message in your hands. A slice of this place, a length of white beach, a piazza or carved spires of a cathedral will pierce the familiar place where you remain, and you will toss on the table this reversible display, a few square inches of where we have strayed and a compression of what we feel. Okay, this one's really fun. This one's called Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes. a little racy here. But those of us who love Emily Dickinson's poetry will recognize in this countless phrases and echoes of Emily Dickinson's poetry. Taking off Emily Dickinson's clothes. First, her tippet made of tulle, easily lifted off her shoulders and laid on the back of a wooden chair. And her bonnet, the bow undone with a light forward pull. Then the long white dress, a more complicated matter, with mother-of-pearl buttons down the back, so tiny and numerous that it takes forever before my hands can part the fabric like a swimmer's dividing water and slip inside. You will want to know that she was standing by an open window in an upstairs bedroom, motionless, a little wide-eyed, looking out at the orchard below, the white dress puddled at her feet on the wide board, hardwood floor. The complexity of women's undergarments in 19th century America is not to be waved off. And I proceeded like a polar explorer through clips, clasps, moorings, catches, straps, and whalebone stays, sailing toward the iceberg of her nakedness. Later, I wrote in a notebook, it was like riding a swan into the night. But of course, I cannot tell you everything. The way she closed her eyes to the orchard, how her hair tumbled free of its pins, how there were sudden dashes whenever we spoke. What I can tell you is it was terribly quiet in Amherst that Sabbath afternoon. Nothing but a carriage passing the house, a fly buzzing in a window pane. So I could plainly hear her inhale when I undid the very top hook and eye fastener of her corset. And I could hear her sigh when finally it was unloosed, the way some readers sigh when they realize that hope has feathers, that reason is a plank, that life is a loaded gun that looks right at you with a yellow eye. All references from some of her poems.
David, yeah. I don't know if I should confess this, but in January when you were up here with students and I was reading a lot of Billy Collins and the Iraq political problem happened, I wrote a poem called Undressing George Bush.
Save for the after midnight in the left.
We're all very curious.
Okay, here's another one entitled Sonnet, in which he has written 14 lines, and it's not quite a sonnet. It doesn't have the rhyme scheme of a sonnet or quite the perfect iambic pentameter, but it's fun to hear how he plays with the 14-line sonnet form. And especially the reference to Petrarch, the Italian who gave his name to the Petrarchan sonnet, writing love sonnets to Laura, his beloved. Sonnet. All we need is 14 lines. Well, 13 now. And after this one, just a dozen. To launch a little ship on love's storm-tossed seas. Then only 10 more left, like rows of beans. How easily it goes, unless you get Elizabethan and insist the iambic bongos must be played, and rhymes positioned at the ends of lines, one for every station of the cross. But hang on here while we make the turn into the final six, where all will be resolved, where longing and heartache will find an end, where Laura will tell Petrarch to put down his pen, take off those crazy medieval tights, blow out the lights, and come at last to bed. And then here's one where he makes fun of our linguistic idioms. And I'll try to signal with one set of quotation marks every time an idiom is put into quotation marks here in the poem. It's called idiomatic. It is a big question to pose so early in the morning or in the light woven by birds, as the Estonians say. But still I must ask, what is my place in life? My seat on the invisible train, as they say in Hungary. I mean, why am I just sitting here in a lawn chair listening to a thrush, the little entertainer of the woods, as the Swiss call him, while out there in the world, most mobs of people are rushing over bridges in and out of cities. Vegetables grow heavy in their fields. Clouds fly across the face of the earth, as we call it in English. And sometimes rockets lift off in the distance. And I mean that quite literally, from the top of the table, as the Portuguese have it. Real rockets rising from the horizon, or the big line, if you're an Australian, leaving behind rich gowns of exhaust smoke, long smooth trajectories, and always the ocean below. The water machine, as the South Sea Islanders put it. Everything taking place right on schedule, by the clock of the devil, as our grandparents were fond of saying. And still here I sit with my shirt off, the dog at my side, daydreaming, juggling balls of cotton, as they like to say in France. Putting as many international cliches as he can into that one. Now, a few poems that aren't specifically about literature, but about human characteristics. Perhaps my all-time favorite, or at least second favorite poem by him, is one entitled Forgetfulness, and it speaks quite effectively to all of us. Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. As if one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away, a state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle. The capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall. Well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart. He's always surprising us, especially at the end, with some unexpected twist in metaphor. He writes effectively on death. Here's one entitled, My Number. Is death miles away from this house, reaching for a widow in Cincinnati, or breathing down the neck of a lost hiker in British Columbia? Is he too busy making arrangements, tampering with air brakes, scattering cancer cells like seeds, loosening the wooden beams of roller coasters to bother with my hidden cottage that visitors find so hard to find? Or is he stepping from a black car parked at the dark end of the lane, shaking open the familiar cloak, its hood raised like the head of a crow, and removing the scythe from the trunk? Did you have any trouble with the directions, I will ask, as I start talking my way out of this? About passengers and tests show our worry and fear about trips with others. Passengers. At the gate, I sit in a row of blue seats with the possible company of my death, this sprawling miscellany of people, carry-on bags and paperbacks that could be gathered in a flash into a band of pilgrims on the last open road. Not that I think if our plane crumpled into a mountain, we would all ascend together, holding hands like a ring of skydivers, into a sudden gasp of brightness, or that there would be some common spot for us to reunite, to jubilize the moment, some spaceless, pillarless Greece, where we could, at the count of three, toss our ashes into the sunny air. It's just that the way that man has his briefcase so carefully arranged, the way that girl is cooling her tea, and the flow of the comb that woman passes through her daughter's hair. And when you consider the altitude, the secret parts of the engines, and all the hard water and the deep canyons below, well, I just think it would be good if one of us maybe stood up and said a few words. Or, so as not to involve the police, at least quietly wrote something down. This is one entitled Consolation. Anytime that we are not traveling and all of our friends are, This is a nice consolation poem, because we're all where we want to be right now, so this doesn't speak to us right now, but someday when you're at home and everyone else is on vacation, here's consolation. How agreeable it is not to be touring Italy this summer. Wandering her cities and ascending her torrid hill towns. How much better to cruise these local, familiar streets, fully grasping the meaning of every road sign and billboard and all the sudden hand gestures of my compatriots. There are no abbeys here, no crumbling frescoes or famous domes, and there is no need to memorize a succession of kings or tour the dripping corners of a dungeon. No need to stand around the sarcophagus, see Napoleon's little bed on Elba, or view the bones of a saint under glass. How much better to command the simple precinct of home than be dwarfed by pillar, arch, and basilica? Why hide my head in phrase books and wrinkled maps? Why feed scenery into a hungry one-eyed camera eager to eat the world one monument at a time. Instead of slouching in a cafe, ignorant of the word for ice, I will head down to the coffee shop and the waitress known as Dot. I will slide into the flow of the morning paper, all language barriers down, rivers of idiom running freely, eggs over easy on the way. And after breakfast, I will not have to find someone willing to photograph me with my arm around the owner. I will not puzzle over the bill or record in a journal what I had to eat and how the sun came in the window. It is enough to climb back into the car as if it were the great car of English itself, and sounding my loud vernacular horn, speed off down a road that will never lead to Rome, not even Bologna. Every time I read one of his poems, I think, I wish I had written that. Perhaps some of you are thinking the same thing. They really are quite accessible. You know, they aren't poems that we just can't figure out, but they are almost universally clever and creative and forcing us out of our usual way of thinking within the box and thinking us beyond.
Bill? It begs the question, why do the poets write poems that they don't want anybody to figure out?
They're hoping we'll be smarter than we are.
They're hoping we think that they're smarter than we are. Yeah.
And this is one of Billy Collins' missions in life, is to introduce us to poems that we can understand basically on the first reading or first hearing, and not have to go to college and have a professor at your elbow the whole life to explain this kind of thing and that. And I think he's doing a good job of it. This one is called Dharma. Here's one of the sort of ordinary little things of life. The way the dog trots out the front door every morning without a hat or an umbrella, without any money or the keys to her doghouse, never fails to fill the saucer of my heart with milky admiration. Who provides a finer example of a life without encumbrance? Thoreau in his curtainless hut with a single plate, a single spoon? Gandhi with his staff and his holy diapers? Off she goes into the material world with nothing but her brown coat and her modest blue collar, following only her wet nose, the twin portals of her steady breathing, followed only by the plume of her tail. If only she did not shove the cat aside every morning and eat all his food. What a model of self-containment she would be. What a paragon of earthly detachment. If only she were not so eager for a rub behind the ears, so acrobatic in her welcomes. If only I were not her god. Then here's a couple that have kind of a fun use of biblical and theological references. This one is called Questions About Angels. Of all the questions you might want to ask about angels, the only one you ever hear is how many can dance on the head of a pin. No curiosity about how they pass the eternal time besides circling the throne, chanting in Latin, or delivering a crust of bread to a hermit on earth, or guiding a boy and girl across a rickety wooden bridge. Do they fly through God's body and come out singing? Do they swing like children from the hinges of the spirit world sing their names backwards and forwards? Do they sit alone in little gardens, changing colors? What about their sleeping habits, the fabric of their robes, their diet of unfiltered divine light? What goes on inside their luminous heads? Is there a wall these tall presences can look over and see hell? If an angel fell off a cloud, would he leave a hole in a river? And would the hole float along endlessly, filled with the silent letters of every angelic word? If an angel delivered the mail, would he arrive in a blinding rush of wings? Or would he just assume the appearance of the regular mailman and whistle up the driveway reading the postcards? No, the medieval theologians control the court. The only question you ever hear is about the little dance floor on the head of the pin, where halos are meant to converge and drift invisibly. It is designed to make us think in millions, billions, to make us run out of numbers and collapse into infinity. But perhaps the answer is simply one. One female angel dancing alone in her stocking feet. A small jazz combo working in the background. She sways like a branch in the wind, her beautiful eyes closed, and the tall, thin bassist leans over to glance at his watch, because she has been dancing forever, and now it is very late, even for musicians. I think I'll skip over to a couple about time, where you can hear his, a couple more where he's really interested in thinking of time in a different way. This one is called Dancing Toward Bethlehem, take off on slouching toward Bethlehem. If there is only enough time in the final minutes of the 20th century for one last dance, I would like to be dancing it slowly with you, say in the ballroom of a seaside hotel. My palm would press into the small of your back as the past 100 years collapsed into a pile of mirrors or buttons or frivolous shoes. Just as the floor of the 19th century gave way and disappeared in a red cloud of brick dust. There will be no time to order another drink or worry about what was never said. Not with the orchestra sliding into the sea and all our attention devoted to humming whatever it was they were playing. Here's one called Bar Time. Got about 5 minutes to go. Bar time. In keeping with universal saloon practice, the clock here is set 15 minutes ahead of all the clocks in the outside world. This makes us a rather advanced group, doing our drinking in the unknown future, immune from the cares of the present, safely harbored a quarter of an hour beyond the woes of the contemporary scene. No wonder such thoughtless pleasure derives from tending the small fire of a cigarette, from observing this glass of whiskey and ice, the cold rust I am sipping, or from having an eye on the street outside when ordinary time slouches past in a top coat, rain running off the brim of his hat, the late edition like a flag in his pocket. I'm going to read a bucolic poem entitled Afternoon with Irish Cows. And, you know, it's one of these many poems that shows us how, if we're paying attention and noticing things carefully, the most mundane topic can inspire us to good language. afternoon with Irish cows. There were a few dozen who occupied the field across the road from where we lived, stepping all day from tuft to tuft, their big heads down in the soft grass, though I would sometimes pass a window and look out to see the field suddenly empty, as if they had taken wing, flown off to another country. Then later I would open the blue front door, and again the field would be full of their munching, or they would be lying down on the black and white maps of their sides, facing in all directions, waiting for rain. How mysterious, how patient and dumbfounded they appeared in the long quiet of the afternoon. But every once in a while, one of them would let out a sound so phenomenal that I would put down the paper or the knife I was cutting an apple with and walk across the road to the stone wall to see which one of them was being torched or pierced through the side with a long spear. Yes, it sounded like pain until I could see the noisy one, anchored there on all fours, her neck outstretched, her bellowing head laboring upward as she gave voice to the rising, full-bodied cry that began in the darkness of her belly and echoed up through her bowed ribs into her gaping mouth. Then I knew that she was only announcing the large, unadulterated cowness of herself, pouring out the ancient apologia of her kind to all the green fields and the gray clouds, to the limestone hills and the inlet of the blue bay, while she regarded my head and shoulders above the wall with one wild, shocking eye. It is time to be done. I'll get just a second. The book I've been reading from is entitled Sailing Alone Around the Room, New and Collected Poems by Billy Collins. There are many, many more in here and other books by Billy Collins that contain similar delights.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a comment because it's so pleasant to hear it read out loud. That if you have this book and you're reading to yourself, you'll sit there with a smile on your face a lot. But you don't, you take that next step where you're kind of sharing it and laughing right out loud. And so the value of things on the page as well as in our own mouths, I mean, reading to yourself out loud these poems.
Yeah. Poetry needs to be heard, whether it's your own voice or someone else's or the poet's. And, I commend you to some regularity of poetry in your life. Thanks very much for coming.